Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to another episode of the Daily French Show. I am your host, Harm. And today I am joined by Mr. Herman Pretorius. Herman, how are you?
Nick, I am fine. Thank you very, very much. The script just says inserts witty banter, and I didn't prepare anything.
That shall be marked against your permanent record, Herman, I'm afraid. And of course, we have the gracious, wonderful, and wise Ms. Sarah Gon. Sarah, how are you?
All the better for hearing from you, Nick.
Very good. All right, let us get into the thick of it, as we all want to do. And we talked a little bit earlier this week about the riots in South Africa, kind of a bit of a retrospective on them. But there's been some interesting stories written recently that I thought maybe we could comment on, just as kind of, I guess, probably our last thoughts on the riots, at least for now. And there were two separate articles that were very interesting. The first one was one done by a website called New Frame. And the title, the headline was "Looters Remorseful as Daily Life Gets Tougher." And it's just a good story in that it kind of gives a bit of human texture to the cost of these riots, away from the kind of talking heads and the people who suggest that, you know, it's only big business who suffered from this. The article went on to interview various people close to malls that had been basically burned down during the riots. There was a guy who runs a shack shop just across the road from one of the shopping centers where he sold Fetcook. And now the destruction of the mall means he gets very few customers. There was someone who worked in a hair salon there. There was someone who owned a hair salon there. A small businessman from Ghana who was employed for South Africans. He had to spend 250,000 rand to rebuild his shop. There was someone who worked for a gym company. She rents a room in a shack and walks to work, and now she's basically lost her job because the gym is gone. There's other people who they still kept their job, but they now have to spend money on transport. And lastly, the article interviews a couple of people who were involved in the riots. And this is quite interesting just because I think one of the things it does is it shows how non-political, in a sense, some of these rioters were. The one guy, he was a 31-year-old man who lives in a shack in Chatsworth. He said, "I'm not working and COVID-19 has taken away even the peace jobs we are doing. When I saw people going to loot, I also went because I have nothing here. I looted mostly food. My shack is small, so I had to sell some of the stuff I took." And another woman said, "It was peer pressure, really. I took food items, but now our mall is gone." And it's kind of, I don't know, I find it emotionally sort of a little bit difficult to deal with because on one hand, I don't have much remorse for people who are involved with the looting. But on the other hand, there's a sort of tragedy to this whole thing that's quite interesting. And really, I think peer pressure is actually, at the end of the day, a large reason for what happened. Herman, your thoughts on this? And we'll get into the second part of the story just now. But your thoughts on this human aspect?
Oh my goodness. I'm put in mind of the 1992 LA riots, where I think it was a guy called Mike Stennis, a black business owner, a relatively famous video of the 1992 riots, where he was the business owner and, you know, a small businessman, running a shop or a business that his parents had started before he was born, that was either vandalized, you know, in the extreme or burned down. And it haunts because it is so convenient to discount business interests as some sort of inanimate corporate thing that pity and compassion doesn't always flow there where it needs to flow. And one does feel pity for the people so desperate and poor that they turn to looting. But feeling pity does not for a moment mean condoning their actions or seeking excuses for them. But what I do think is interesting here about the argument of peer pressure, and I do think it is a valid point. It is a reason and not an excuse. People must differentiate between those very clearly. An excuse is you exhibit, you know, indemnify you. It's with regards to blame. Reason is just purely causal linkage. I do think that in the argument of peer pressure, there is some truth, and I think that speaks to the degeneration of South Africa's societal moral fiber, that we have so loosened our connections with community. We have so undermined the skin in the game that the individual could have in the community. And perhaps liberalism has contributed to that. Perhaps the spirit of individualism, unrestrained by that, does contribute to it, although I don't quite buy that, but I do see some merit in the argument that we have to acknowledge that these sorts of things are real, and that lawlessness and societal breakdown happens in a weirdly psychological collective way. The question is then what to do about it. And I can't see collective solutions, unfortunately. I can only see solutions based on the individual being empowered, on the individual finding a stake in their community and a stake in society, having skin in the game. And that's why I think Margaret Thatcher's idea of the property-owning democracy is really probably the best bet for a liberal democratic country, or a country aspiring to be that, is you can't want the state to protect everything or do everything. If you want private citizens to be invested in their communities, they need property rights. They need to feel involved. They need to feel that, no, peer pressure cannot push me beyond this point, as convenient as it might be, because there are consequences for me, my family, my life. So, yes, one does feel pity and one does feel remorse and so on. But I do think that once you've robbed someone of their dignity and their membership of society and their ability to strengthen those ties, I mean, then these things are probably unavoidable.
Sara, your thoughts on that before we move on to part two of this?
Yeah, just to add that, you know, it's fairly well established that when people sort of get riled up in the mob scenario, the individual personality kind of disappears and is replaced by being part of the mob. So it's almost like losing their individual identity. And I mean, I think that the same would go for the BLM riots. The problem, of course, what happens then is that the impulse to loot or to steal, whatever it may be, and the stealing is of the moment, and the regret will come later. Because, of course, we all knew that any action of that nature is going to be very hard on the people they live with, on their own friends, on their own family. It may even affect the support that they receive from other people. That's why I think, you know, you can't say there will be other breakouts the same as this. I think these riots were a bit like the BLM riots in the sense that they were very specific. And I think those who certainly encourage or instigated aspects of the rioting deserve absolutely everything they get, because it is always the people in the environment in which the damage is done and from which goods are stolen that suffer the most. Now having to travel, not being able to get access to food nearby, etc., etc. This contrasts with the people who burned the trucks. That's a very different, very much gang.
Yeah, no, I think that's definitely right.
And I think the very fact that, you know, you essentially, in the overall scheme of things, you're looking at people in poor circumstances being caught up in sort of mob action, taking advantage when people are not that well off, there's going to largely be remorse at the end of it. Whether whatever reason they may give to excuse it or explain it, it doesn't matter. And that's why I'm not sure that these events happen again that soon and that easily, because I don't think, because
at least not in KZN, maybe.
Well, not even anywhere, because I think what people will have taken out before, while it was happening and afterwards, is that the damage done to the communities that are responding to the incitement is huge. It's devastating. It may not seem big on the scale of trucks burning, etc., but in the individual capacity, that having to pay for transport that didn't have to be paid for before, that having to get 22 kilometers to a place that sells food because the mile across the road has been burned down, those are immediate inconveniences and they have long-term consequences. So I think the terrible thing is that as it was happening, one knew this is the realization people would ultimately be left with.
Nick, can I quickly just say something there, because I keep an eye on the comments. It's always quite fascinating and interesting to see these comments. I do think that something Sarah said is quite an effective counter to this idea that someone commented saying cultural pride is the only quick fix. Now, I do agree with Sarah on this, is that it was a step away from the individual and a step towards collectivism that allows this sort of innocence by numbers, peer pressure sort of argument to go. Cultural pride might be a fix, but it's certainly not a quick one, nor do I think it's the first step. I'm a proud Afrikaner, but I am that secondary to my liberalism that requires me to see that right to be a proud Afrikaner and give it freely to someone who wants to be a proud Zulu or a proud Jew or a proud American or whatever identity they want to choose for themselves. So I do think that you have to start with the individual having the self-confidence and the freedom to identify their group associations. And then a second comment that I do think needs to be picked up is most problems, if not all, in this country stems from the immense lack of critical thinking by the general population. And I'm sorry, but I can't but see the shadow of Hendrik Verwoerd standing behind that sort of sentiment, because it is this sort of centralized idea that the people are too stupid to think for themselves, they must be thought on behalf of, that leads to socialism. I think if you've spent enough time with a common man, historically, as a countervailing force for the concentration of power, you see more good emerging from the common man than bad. I think one can take a leaf from Martin Luther's book, where his movement of historical significance was a populist one, in the sense that it was for him important that the sacred texts of his religion be available and accessible to the common man, and it was then the common man that was the driver of a liberal movement of that time. So let's be very, very, very careful when we fall into that sort of, oh, the masses can't think for themselves thinking. I'm not saying people are doing that, but I think it's immensely dangerous and quite illiberal.
See, this is why I love the Daily Friend Show, because we draw lessons from the life of a 16th century religious reformer to talk about South Africa today. Anyway, so let's talk about part two of this, and this is actually quite interesting, and Sarah gave me a good segue into this bit, which Herman then proceeded to step on, and that is that according to the South African Special Risk Insurance Association, which is part of the National Treasury, so it's part of government, and they cover risks like riots, terrorism, strikes, that kind of thing. The riots we had in South Africa were more expensive than the Black Lives Matter, George Floyd riots and protests in the United States. So the damage caused in those riots were estimated at around $1.5 billion, which is kind of around 20 billion rand. And the South African Special Risk Insurance Association says that our riots cost somewhere between 20 billion and 25 billion rand. So on the higher end, actually more expensive than the American ones, which I think is quite shocking, actually. And as a result of this, this Department of National Treasury, which is not, unlike most parts of government, in the habit of losing money by enormous amounts all the time, has basically gone close to bankrupt. It's now asking government for 3.9 billion rand cash injection to keep itself basically able to pay off all of the insurance that it owes. Sorry, your thoughts on this before we move on?
Yeah, I mean, obviously what would have aggravated is the fact that large entities, shopping centers, car sales areas, warehouses were deliberately targeted. So those automatically are high cost items. And then, of course, the trucks that were burnt. I mean, there you're talking, particularly in the bigger trucks, you're talking, you know, over R1 million worth of truck on each occasion. Whereas even the BLM riots, individual shop owners were badly affected, but it was very much the damage caused by the mob, and probably would have been the same of the damage caused by the ordinary, if I can say ordinary mob in this case, with looting, etc. But as soon as you destroying big capital items like trucks or shopping centers,
yeah,
the costs are going to go up very, very dramatically. And for all the reasons, for all the issues we've spoken about this, and for this as well, there's a special place in hell for the people who incited this behavior. Whether and frankly for Jacob Zuma, whether he was involved inciting or acted as the inspiration for it. Because I think whatever might have been in the minds of people who thought this would be a good idea, doing damage and negatively affecting the ANC was one thing, but the disaster, the cost to the society in financial and in human terms is unforgivable.
Indeed. And it's actually that I think is part of the reason why I think that some good still may come out of these riots, in the sense that I think it was such a shocking moment and such a destructive moment that a lot of South Africans who had sort of sleepily been sitting on the sidelines and just putting their heads down and not really thinking about where we were headed were perhaps, I'm hopeful, shocked into realizing that we need to change direction, because obviously things are not going as they should. Anyway, let us move on to our next topic. And this is based off of a question asked by the Democratic Alliance in the Western Cape. They asked the President's National Council on Gender-Based Violence to resolve the DNA analysis backlog in the Western Cape. Of course, the police are run by national government, which is why the provincial government is asking for help on this. And according to the DA-run provincial government in the Western Cape, there are more than 36,000 sexual offense cases were outstanding as a result of neglected machines at the South African Police Service Forensic Science Laboratory in Platteekloof. So this is not the first time I think we've heard this. I think this is very focused on like the sexual offense crimes, but we also know that things like murders, the DNA backlogs are really bad. And sorry, you had some thoughts on this.
Oh, yes, I do. What's criminal about this, pun intended, is that the one advantage of DNA evidence is it has made the reliance on very wide investigation to a large extent redundant. Because if you can pick up useful DNA evidence, you can literally hang a conviction on it. Here you have, and it's one of those issues, you know, raised with gender-based violence that, and I mean, we've seen some awful murders of women by our partners, etc., is that, you know, it's a very complex issue. It cannot be entirely solved by the police. The police cannot take responsibility for preventing it from happening. That's a whole range of other actors in society's responsibility to do. The thing that the police are there to do is to investigate incidents and prepare them for prosecutors to take to trial. Now, the maintenance agreement ran out in 2019. I mean, that is just an absolute disgrace that it was allowed to run out, and 2 years later, there is still no maintenance agreement. I mean, it's an area of desperate need. It would solve, from a policing point of view, a huge number of problems, and they haven't got working machines. I mean, in the private sector, any laboratory that provided that sort of service would have been out of business years ago. And it just defies comprehension. I mean, you know, if the government had the sense to say, well, let's outsource this to a private entity and we can pay them, it'd at least get done. But to have these sorts of backlogs means that a whole lot of people who could easily be jailed for the crime they committed, it'll never happen. And I think symptomatic of the disgrace of ANC rule, of the many disgraces. But there's something about this that is just, come on, guys, this is just technical. Get it done.
Right. I really like that point, actually, about how, you know, this actually puts more strain on the police, because without DNA evidence, if you want to catch a murderer, you can't just, you know, get the DNA and sort the thing out there. You have to do much more complicated, much deeper inquest into exactly what's going on. And that can take time and energy away from other cases as well. Herman, any quick thoughts on this before we move on?
Yeah, I'm just curious as to whether the government has ever heard of this thing called a debit order. I mean, I am not. I'm no great shakes at money management. I mean, that's not a secret at all. I know I'm not good at it. So one of the first things I do when I know there's a running expense that I need to do is I set up a bloody automatic debit order or an automatic payment. There's no thinking that goes into that.
Herman, I've just got to say, I mean, you can have as many debit orders as you like, but if you've stolen the money, there's nothing to pay.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. But I just feel the failure here is so immense that it literally nothing else had to happen than someone just saying, oh, this, we need to spend this regularly. You mean regularly. Cool, let's go. So it really is astounding. But I do want to take it one step a bit further. And yes, this is an ANC failure. And yes, this is a government failure. It's frustrating that we live in a political environment where opposition parties and citizens sort of think that our expectations are so low that we think we can do nothing about it. It really is the core hope and frustration of my existence in my career here, that if every person who voted against the ANC and the EFF went to the trouble of, before the next general election, speaking to one person who didn't vote in the previous election and convinced them to vote for any party other than the ANC and the EFF, we'd have a new governing coalition overnight. You have 7 million voters voting against the ANC-EFF. You've got 11 million voters voting for the ANC-EFF. There are 20 million voters not voting. And the data keeps on showing us that these people are not the rabid, mad, you know, VBS cattle idiots that so often they are portrayed as. These are sensible people with real issues that have just lost faith in politics. So if politics is the solution mechanism we want to use here, at some point, I might be just, you know, not preaching to the choir as much as bitching to it, but to just think that there's, perhaps, you know, next time, when the next general election comes around, I'll make a little note on my daily to-do list. Let's make a little habit of trying to find one person in the 4 weeks before an election who didn't vote and just talk to them about this. Ask them, do you care about the forensics laboratories in this country? Do you care about the ability of police to investigate crimes? Okay, well, then if you do, I've got some news to tell you about it. Just get people involved, because yes, it's an ANC failure, but at some point the failure is more fundamental than that. And sorry for sounding like a really nauseating little teacher's pet or something, but yeah, look at it. I just...
I see one of our commenters is stressing that they do actually take up the cause and that maybe they should make a poster and put it on their gate. Anyway, let us go on to the next story, which I think I don't even know how much there is to say about this, really. But so as we talked about the Correctional Services Commissioner, Arthur Fraser, was asked in an interview to kind of say what exactly was the process behind Jacob Zuma's medical parole. And he said, oh, no, it wasn't the medical parole board that that granted the medical parole for Zuma. It was him personally who did it. But he did not elaborate on why, in fact, he needed to overrule the medical parole board's claims here. Ha, Sara, it seems every day that the very thin tendrils of plausibility that Zuma's excuses have are kind of blowing away in the wind.
Well, you see, the problem is that when the right to award parole is in the hands of either the National Commissioner, which is what Fraser is, or the minister, or the full parole board, it can be either of the three. But the process as set out requires that a medical advice board be established to look into the application, which will have a medical report to go with it. It has to. And in this case, he established such a board, which he has to. And the board said, no, he doesn't warrant parole. Now, it doesn't say in the legislation that he has to be bound by this advice. And he obviously didn't feel he was, because he went ahead and paroled Zuma anyway. And, you know, I don't want to say too much about it. I think it's sort of, from what I've said, it speaks for itself. But it's like, it's like, you know, what else could we have expected? Sorry, Nick.
Nick, you are muted.
This is the second time I've done this in like 2 days. It's really bad. Anyway, any thoughts before we move on? I mean, you know, what more can be said?
Yeah, I do think that there's an interesting angle on this that we should take and just throw out there. It would appear that Jacob Zuma is more powerful in prison than Cyril Ramaphosa in office. because we have seen over the last few weeks the unemployment numbers blamed on him, riots, the inability of the police to act, and now Arthur Fraser, being in the position that he is, was a Ramaphosa appointment. So it's a unique special pleading for Saint Cyril that Arthur Fraser is somehow seen as a Zuma man. Yes, he is a Zuma man, but he's also a Ramaphosa man because, surprise, he's an ANC man. So I must say that if ever anyone is tempted to throw the Saint Cyril card out there, just say the two words Arthur Fraser, and then if they look at you, you know, with a puzzle in their faces, well, that's just how people look at me, but that's fair. I think one can just remind them to say that the reason Zuma got medical parole was because the guy Cyril Ramaphosa appointed to be in charge of this sort of decisions was a Zuma and an ANC lackey. I mean, where in God's name does the buck stop? Sorry, this is a very ranting episode. I'm very ranty today.
Perhaps I can just say, you see, Arthur Fraser formerly was employed by the Secret Services. And it was in that context. I mean, he committed so much no goodness. And yet, however, he didn't manage to be called into the Zondo Commission. So once Ramaphosa came into power, Arthur Fraser had to lose his job. But cadre deployment says you've got to put them somewhere else. And who'd have thunk that Arthur Fraser could be put into a position where he could put Jacob Zuma on parole? It's like schadenfreude.
Really? It's just amazing that Zuma, really, from his jail cell, can get such loyalty from people. One wonders what more complexity there is to this. Anyway, we don't have time to talk about our very last stories today, but thank you very much, everyone, for listening. We hope you enjoyed the show. Please check out the dailyfriend.co.za for a variety of opinions and analysis and news, that kind of stuff. Also, please consider funding us, supporting the Institute of Race Relations, which is, of course, the evil puppet master behind the Daily Friend and all of our various branches, and also other groups affiliated with us. And you can do that by going to the irr.org.za, clicking the Join Us button at the top of the screen, and signing up to become a friend of the Institute. Anyway, thank you very much. We hope you enjoyed the show. Please also review us, like the video, comment on the video, all that good stuff. Also, salute to our audio listeners. And we shall see you next week. Have a fantastic weekend, everyone. Cheers.